Hello everyone. Thanks for coming along to what I'm sure will be a very interesting session just by virtue of the title alone. Anthony is going to be presenting to us on virtue theory and actuarial judgment. Okay. And as many of you know, he's an associate professor in the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies at UNSW, where he lectures in both Part 2 and Part 3 courses. His current extensive research interests include retirement products on which he and advice on which he just presented. So please be understanding because he's doing two presentations in a row. And now he's going to be talking to us about the application of virtue theory. His work experience includes a variety of roles in regulation, superannuation investments and life insurance. He serves on the Institute's research committee, the journal editorial committee, and is convener of the Retirement Incomes Working Group. So can you join me in welcoming Anthony Asher?
Thanks very much, Bridget, and thanks for coming. This is a subject that I've felt that I couldn't really write on until sort of later on in my career, and found in the last couple of years that I've learnt a great deal while trying to do the research, but I've come to the basically the same conclusion that I've had from school days, and it relates and found in the latest developments, academic developments, the revival of virtue theory or virtue ethics. Has only happened in academic circles since 1980, which was after I left school. But I do think it is most convincing and most helpful way of looking at ethics from a professional perspective and a sort of joint communities perspective. So I'm going to talk virtue theory and ethics, why about virtue theory, what it is. I'll show you a couple of diagrams, and then I'll talk about developing the virtues, and particularly in the actuarial profession, and effectively saying that the virtues are required before the virtues of wisdom and justice are required before we can really say we've developed actuarial judgment. Little luck, we now got most of the audience. So, ethics are problematic. Why don't we like talking about ethics? They're difficult to define. They're poorly defined, partly because they've been used in so many different ways for so long. I mean, we're talking 3,000-4,000 years, that the words have got many, many meanings and are used in completely different ways by different people. They're not agreed upon anyway, because the whole point about ethics is they say to us very often, we're wrong, so we've got to change. So of course we're going to debate them. And it's impossible to actually measure what people really believe, because we lie, or we dissemble, or we don't tell the entire truth. And it's very often not just because we're telling lies to other people, but we don't even know ourselves what is motivating us. And I mean, if you haven't discovered that, well, that's something, you know, do as you grow older, for the younger members of this audience. But it's very, very often we find that our motivation. I mean, one of the things that I'm doing is one of the things I've done as part of this work is I've written a book which is coming out shortly, called "Working Ethically in Finance: Clarifying Our Vocation." And one of the things about thinking about my own vocation and the own drivers of what I did in my younger days was to see how much I was motivated, as much by my self-interest in the withdrawal benefits from Superfund as the cost to other people. That self-interest just helped to clarify things. The indignation that I got at injustice was partly related to me and my friends as much and family. But okay, ethics are not impossible to enforce. We have laws. All countries have laws. We operate with laws. The laws protect life and property and enforce contracts. And higher professional standards over and above the laws are applied virtually universally. And one of the things we have in one of the interesting quotes I have in the paper is from the International Actuarial Association. 72 countries, no difference in actuarial standards around them, or no apparent arguments about it. Although John Shepherd, when he looked at this, said, yeah, well, I was on that committee, and perhaps some of the non-English speakers weren't perhaps as forceful in expressing their opinions as they might have been. But I've debated this with my class, with my students, and we, the week before last, we had 14 different nationalities from four continents, and there was no real difference. And that included the subcontinent, and it included East Asia, and it included Africa, and it included Eastern Europe. There are really no differences in the ultimate question of integrity, avoiding conflicts of interest, quality work. That's universal. Okay, their personal challenge. We feel guilty. And not just do we not recognize our own motivations, but when we are guilty in some respect, we get angry and project what our own weaknesses on other people. That's the subject of a lot of literature. So disagreements become unpleasant, or conversation degenerates into... Okay, so either become unpleasant or boring. You know, sermons are boring. There's not much you can say. And not so much you can say without scratching and really annoying people. So it's quite a difficult thing to do, to talk about ethics. But they're necessary for flourishing. We need a personal idea of what a good life is, and we need rules for interacting in society, and to have a common aims. And those are ethical to a very large degree. If we need ambitions. So they're not aspirational. They're not spontaneous, but they are aspirational. I think I'll just read this because I do think it's from David Carr, who's an educationalist. No rational being can understand what a quality like courage, temperance, justice is, and yet fail to want to possess it. From this point of view, because the virtues are not innate, but entail a proper habit formation and the development of reason, it's squarely within the responsibility of those concerned with the socialization and education of children, parents, teachers, etc., to ensure that such habituation and instruction takes place. So we need to teach ethics and remind ourselves. And then this very crusty comment. There are legions of young people who continue to perceive what is admirable about virtue through the fog of lies that has been woven about her, and to live lives of self-respect, decency, sobriety, and genuine altruism. There are far too many others who have been blinded by the rhetoric, who've come to believe that morality is a matter of reluctantly doing one's duty when this cannot be avoided, and otherwise going to the devil. Yeah. So, all right. Virtue is a good thing, and I'll hopefully persuade you that, in fact, it can be. We can agree that it is a good thing. It's something to aspire to, and it's not something that is, you know, reluctantly doing one's duty when it can't be avoided, and that is that's poison. So, the cardinal virtues. These come to us from Plato and Aristotle. They're 2,000 years old. They were incorporated into medieval Christian theology by Thomas Aquinas. They can be found in Judaism, Islam, and I'll talk about, and Confucianism to a degree, which are all virtue-based. This diagram is mine, so you can criticize it as much. This is one you may criticize as much as you like, and I might take your criticisms on board. All right, so there are four virtues. I've divided them into these, courage and self-control, which I think are reactive and internal to a degree. Reactive, not internal. And these which are active. So these are who we are, these are what we do, and the objective is human flourishing, why we do it. And then the bottom two, self-control and wisdom, are personal, and the top two are social. So let me just describe how we're going about this. We start with self-control, which is perhaps the most, in some respect, the most need self-control. Walter Mischel, sorry, for those of you who were in the earlier session, I talked about Walter Mischel and the marshmallow test. Who hasn't heard of the marshmallow test? All right, so we'll act as Bridget will do the marshmallow test. Bridget, here's a marshmallow. You're 6 years old now. If you don't eat it until I come again in 10 minutes, you can have two. experimenter goes out the room, and that's right, next day, that's right, and he'd come back. Now, Bridget didn't eat it. She would outperform her colleagues who did eat it at school, at university, in how much she earns, whether she got married or not, and whether she was and not less likely to get divorced again 30 years later. All right, so it's self-control is a really important part of personal success. And this, I mean, the book, he's written the book called The Marshmallow Test, Walter Mischel, 30 years of experimentation that he's done with various other colleagues in psychology. Lovely little stories, how you develop it, how you teach yourself to be self-controlled, and how it can be improved. How the boys in front of the marshmallow do dance, sort of try and squirm in their seats and do various things. How the girls sing to themselves. Different ways we deal with self-control. Self-control is important. And clearly self-control is massively important for actuaries. I mean, to cope with 7 years post-university education, we all have a high level of self-control. Although he makes the point, Bill Clinton also had a high level of self-control, but it wasn't necessarily universally applied in his life. So self-control governs our personal appetites and inclination. It makes us more of who we want to be. It's a conscious. When we know about self-control, we want to be self-controlled, and we work, and there's techniques of doing that, and we can improve. We can improve our self-control as a virtue. Courage has got similar. I think courage is similar to self-control in the sense, but it's not self-control. We control what's internal to us. Courage, we resist what's external to us. When we protect our integrity, ourself, our family, our interests, or whatever it is, because we resist pressures from outside. So I think they are linked in that sense on that who we are. Justice governs the social impacts of our interactions. So justice gives everyone else their due. When we have power over them, it makes sure that we don't abuse that power. It's fair. It's making sure that we get actuarial equity. It's interesting. The economists call about actuarial equity. Value of premiums equals value of benefits. Value of contributions equals value of benefits. Present value allowing for probabilities and all the rest. So justice is an important virtue. And then clearly wisdom. The personal consequences of our actions are productive, sometimes called prudence. Aristotle calls it practical wisdom. Its application, it's preserving ourselves and making decisions that actually are effective and work well. So that gives, who we are, what we do, and why we do it are sometimes seen as different theories of philosophical theories of virtue. So these are to do with character, these are to do with the rules that govern our behavior, sometimes called the deontological theories that relate to our duties and what we're due to give others, and then why we do it can be is effectively covered by the teleological theories, where we go into. So such as utilitarianism is a very well known teleological theory. The arguments would be that sometimes utilitarian, you don't want to define our utility too narrowly, just in financial terms. So virtues are aspirations. We acquire them by practice, reflective practice. Communities encourage them and shame their absence. They bring a sense of identity and self-efficacy, and our koan, we want to learn to live and forgive ourselves. Now, it's important, the line around this, integrity. And I find it's interesting, one of the things when I mention it in the classroom, and I say we all want to have integrity, none of us want to be two-faced. We all want to have to tell the same story to our parents and to our friends and to our lecturers. That brings a really strong, I get a strong feel that there's a strong agreement on that. There's generally universal agreement on the question of integrity. Occasionally, there are some cultures that give some value to the trickster. Lucky and Brer Rabbit or various other little myths like that. I think most of those can be explained by the fact that very often it's the trickster who is pulling the tail or whatever he is of people in authority who are worse, or who are hypocrites. So it's actually the trickster brings down the hypocrite, which in fact is to actually affirm integrity at an important level. Now, this is really the VIA value in inventory of something. Sorry, strengths. It's positive psychology. McGraw is quoted here, but there's another guy whose name I forget. I'll come to me. Who's done most of the work? 1.2 million people have gone onto the website and answered this 200 question value of strengths. And analyzing that carefully shows that they are clustered in various ways. They're all regarded as strengths. They're clustered in various ways. And interestingly enough, this is using cluster analysis, not starting with justice, courage, wisdom, and self-control and integrity, but trying to pull these things together. They have come together in five clusters, which I find quite remarkable, given that this is the Greek observations from 2,500 years ago. I will admit the VIA people started off with the virtues, but they have changed their structure a little bit, and I find it is interesting because I think the way that they're clustered in a sense gives us an insight into the nature of the virtues, and I won't go into them in a big way, but I mean, for instance, courage is clustered with humor and social IQ and creativity. I actually find that quite helpful in some respects, because the one thing about courage, and the editor of my book is Mary Gentile, who runs this program called Giving Voice to Values, which is effectively trying to encourage business students to give voice to the values they have. And one of the clear things about if you want to give voice to your values, you've got to prepare yourself. You've got to know them. You've got to know where it becomes a problem. And you've got to be able to voice the issue as soon as possible in such a way that it's not threatening and that type of thing. I mean, the example I give my students is the first time I was asked, I was in a business meeting where the company I worked for was asked for a bribe, the person who was asking for it was working up to something like this. And I was able to ask before he actually asked for it, say, well, if you phrase it like that, sounds as though you're asking for a bribe, and clearly we can't get involved with something like that. Which my colleagues were not tempted. How could they, after that, accept anything? And the person knew to back off. Well, so it was a bit courageous at that point, but not nearly as courageous as it would have to have been had he then asked for it, and then we would have had to have had the debate about whether we were going to pay the commission on the scheme to the trustee or not, which was in this particular case. I'm convinced that one needs to be prepared for courage and some creativity, etc. And the other thing about the other one is interesting, self-control, the self-regulation. One of the things that Walter Mischel has confirmed is that self-control is a future orientation. I want two marshmallows in 10 minutes' time. I'm prepared to resist the temptations of the present and focus on the future. So I won't go through this in great detail, but you can. It's therefore not difficult to reconcile this model with Christian, Confucius, Islam, Buddhism, and then some of the modern social science theories. Of course, I do have a problem with a lot of these, is that they're reinventing the wheel, because this has been around, this has been around 2,000 years and is present in all the religions. Why are we trying to think of new sets of values? As G.K. Chesterton says about modern philosophy, how can you have a modern philosophy? It's like saying, have you a Monday philosophy, which you then change on Tuesday. If it was true previously, it must be true now. I'm convinced that's a reasonable argument. What it's not consistent with is positive economics. I don't know the extent to which one needs to address positive economics. Basically says, if you take the expression of it in Milton Friedman's 1953 paper, positive economics is only interested in not in normative, it's not wanting to make value judgments, and interestingly enough, it's not even interested in the assumptions. He's only interested in whether the theory gives us some insight into the world out there. He's interested in abstract theory that gives insight. So, in fact, it's unprofessional. An actuary can't be a positive economist because actuaries have to consider their assumptions. You know, assumptions have to be good. Friedman says assumptions are dangerous. Explicitly says that in that paper. He also says values are don't come into play, and clearly as professionals we have to bring our values into play. But what we teach the students, there is no ethics in 4 or 5 years of actuarial university theory. Nothing. Nothing explicit. In fact, they're taught that a proper understanding of the reality is best learnt by taking out what you think ought to be. And that is, as has been said by a number of people, that actually denies our reality. We have a view of what ought to be all around. So if we deny our self-interest, we deny our particular view of the ought, we lose. We get into some really ridiculous situations. I mean, the prime example that is used by Michael Polanyi are the Marxists. They deny morality. But they're driven by this huge indignation at the way some people are rich and other people are poor. And they ended up murdering the rich. And then the middle class. You know, and then the poor. By throwing out morality, they got themselves into a huge mess. And I think the economists and finance generally has got itself into a fair mess by throwing out morality. Example. Have I got time? There's the honesty game. So the economists have done this little research, or some of the economists have done the research. Flip the coin 10 times. I'll give you $10 for every time you flip a head. Flip your coin, don't tell me, and then come and claim your prize from me later. Okay, and then I'll mark out who got whom, how many got in heads. I've got a nice nice binomial distribution. All right? Except, of course, not quite binomial, because some people exaggerate the number of heads they've got. Right, so that tells how honest the group is without, you know, untested. Nice test. Prime people, get them to read the Ten Commandments before you play the honesty game. Whether they're believers or not, they're more honest. Because they actually value integrity. Right, talk about, all right. Get a group of bankers to play the game. Ask one group, demographic questions. How many children have you got? Where were you born? What university you went to, et cetera, et cetera. And they're no less honest than any other group. Ask them about their careers. Where do you work? Who's your boss? What's the companies you work for? And they are significantly less honest, more dishonest than the control group. Finance is, in fact, become a poisonous environment. Making money has driven out ethics in many, many respects. I think it's very clear that that has been the case in some instances, and we've got a big challenge in the sense to move it back. So how do we do that? So I don't want to spend too much of time on this. Here are the professional skills which can fit into the similar sort of structure: self-management, social skills, social IQ, relating to others, and the technical skills, the judgment that we're looking at. Same objective, same question of who we are, internal, external. The professional skills also fit into this internal, external structure. So, and this is just to summarize what I say in my book, which will be available in June. Got an email today with a picture of the front cover, so it's coming. Identity, it creates an identity, who we are. We're professional actuaries, and this is one of the nice things. You can have some good discussions in my last couple of lectures of our 4-year course. You know, I asked the students, are you different from when you came in? They were matriculants or, you know, schoolboys and girls or first-year students when they came in. They're now actuarial students. They see themselves as different, as you do. We changed our identities as we went through the process. Character, ethical standards, professional standards. There's a community and there's a social purpose about meeting the individual institutional needs, social security, etc. At best, Virtue ethics provides aspirations that are motivating, self-satisfying in a group. So how do we develop them? So here, firstly, is a... I think we can put the skills and the virtues... into the... These are the 10 courses of the International Actuarial Association's syllabus. So into financial mathematics... I think we can talk about self-management and control because you've got deferred, you're learning benefits of deferring satisfaction. We can talk about self-control there, and we can talk about justice and fairness. I don't think you can teach the mathematics of credit cards without saying that people appear to be gouging credit cards. You can see the interest rates go up. You know a lot of people are overcharged. We know that many of the banks in the UK banks had to pay. I think the Australian banks have got away with it. About reimbursing stuff, but the mis-selling scandal on credit life. We know credit life has got these fat margins as it's ripping off the clients. How can we work for businesses that knowingly rip off our clients, particularly the poorer clients who don't understand what they're doing? None of us want to do that. We close our eyes to it, we think it's not important, and maybe it's not a huge amount of money very often. But it leaves a sour taste, I think, in everyone's mouth. So you can talk about it. I mean, if you like it, that's fine, but it is an issue. I mean, if it's gone to court, it's certainly a moral issue, and that's clearly the place to talk about it. So similarly, in economics, we can talk about economic justice, we can talk about integrity in accounting. Surely that's the sort of motive, you know, the thing about auditing, etc., that there's integrity, disclosing things to your stakeholders. We can talk about communication, statistical methods. We can talk about communicating in conflict situations, perhaps introduce courage there. Various ways in which the courses actually, and I'm not suggesting, you know, a quarter of the course on this. I'm suggesting 10 minutes, 3 or 4 times in the 100 hours, 150 hours of work. And perhaps a couple of questions that bring in a sentence or two at the end of a question to say that this is what the ethical expect them to make a comment about ethics. It's part of living. But if it's explicitly taught and structured, it would become very evident that we do value these things, and I think that's important to be reminded of it. And that's the point about the sort of, in a sense, that honesty game, what the research has clearly shown. We all are dishonest at some stages. But we all respond to reminders. We need these sort of regular reminders that we do aspire to integrity. We do aspire to courage and justice and wisdom. So within the community of practice, which is a term that is borrowed from Alistair McIntyre, who's the philosopher that has been most influential in reintroducing virtue ethics into the academic world in a way. And this, so we need induction. We have an induction, quite a good induction. We have the education process. We have professional meetings. We have mentors and role models. Those are weaker than they used to be because of people moving into alternative careers, wider fields, etc. There is a structure that attempts to make sure that people have a mentor for their last 2 years of their educational process. I don't think it's adequately monitored and adequately emphasized. I do think it's important that we continue to develop that and to bring newly qualified actuaries into the profession. Continuing salience, and this is what the technical term is, that ethics should be salient, that we should be reminded on a regular basis. Myths, case studies, stories about how, and we had that this morning in a sense with more than an actuary, with Melinda and Fred and Trevor. Sorry, I don't think we're talking about myths, and they're not so old as to be myths themselves, but there were stories about how they'd done things and how they'd made mistakes and how they'd corrected the mistakes and stood up for things. Professional standards we've got. CPD, bit thin. What is interesting is the faculty and institute in the UK now have a 2-hour requirement. You've got to go watch a movie or something about ethics. Not a lot. But I think that's a useful, that's really a salience thing, which I do think we should be looking at. I think we probably should emphasize peer review a bit more. Not the big formal peer review, but just taking our practice and sharing it with each other, and getting comments about how we perhaps are operating. And just a little bit about, how am I going? Discipline. So, virtue ethics recognizes that we, well, whether theory does or not, we have to recognize that we are all human. We make mistakes. If we don't allow for the mistakes that we make in the way we design our systems, the way we interact with each other, the way we discipline, we are denying who we are, and we are creating problems. So responsive regulation and restorative justice are two terms that are been really... John Braithwaite, who's actually a sociologist at ANU, who I think is probably the best writer on these topics in the world. It's a great guy. And basically he says, if you've got... And I'll come back to the responsive regulation, but just the... I haven't got it here in the slides, but there are two ways of... You make a mistake. Well, I make a mistake. I can have two... There can be two responses of the community to my mistake. Some sort of stigmatization, or some type of restoration. If you stigmatize me, I am effectively expelled from the community. What do I do? Well, if there are more than one of me, we set up a counterculture. So the gang, I mean, this gets from your little gang, from your gangs and teenage gangs and 20-year-old gang. You stigmatize the guys, they set up this counterculture of gangs, and they get the support, the personal support, and a type of gang, there's a gang ethics and whatnot, of loyalty, and you don't split on your mates and all the rest. But it's actually very, very counterproductive. What we've got to do is have a restorative justice, non-stigmatizing, restorative justice. Now, it's not to say that what I've done is wrong, is not important. If I've done something wrong, I really need to deal with it. But I deal with it in a way that I restore whoever I've done wrong, it as much as possible. I do the necessary re-education or whatever, but then I'm reintroduced into the community. Because, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And that is really the adult way of looking at it. You say, well, you know, there's some things you can't forgive. That's nonsense. I mean, I'm South African, and we had, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and a lot of murderers were forgiven, and many of the murderers were, you know, they weren't pleasant. And it's happened, I think, in Ecuador and a number of other countries around the world. If you can have that type of forgiveness and that type of reconciliation in this really tough environment, we can certainly do it in the professional environment. It's really not difficult. And we should also think in terms more broadly, this incarceration of people and stigmatizing of people, pushing them out of the community, just not good enough. We've got to bring them back again. So, in fact, so this is actually from the ATO website, believe it or not. And it's how that responsive regulation starts at the bottom with basically motivational postures, trying to encourage people to want to comply, going to the best of our aspirations and bringing them out. And then only if people don't comply, more and more bigger and bigger hammers, bigger and bigger sticks until people do comply. So one's wanting, the ambition is self-regulation and good ethics. But to have good ethics, one also needs this responsive regulatory pyramid and a structure of restorative justice. okay, I, Sorry, I've got it here. The one thing, how am I getting time wise? Okay, now I'm almost done. 15 over 17. I mean, insider trading is a criminal offence. That's daft. Really don't want to put insider traders in jail. We've done it in South Africa. You fine them. You don't have to prove they're criminal. You just have to prove they made money out of it. That's not difficult. If they made the money, pay it back. It stops it. Quite enough. It also means that we don't have to, it's just like a tax, you know, the Financial Services Board is funded by the insider traders. That would be great. ASIC wouldn't be raising $237 million or whatever they're going to be raising from corporates. It's a particular disaster because only the wealthy can pay the lawyers to get them off. And it's stigmatizing shame. That's the word I was looking for. Stigmatizing shame rather than restorative, reintegrative shaming is a disaster if it creates a counterculture. So we need to take offences seriously. We need to ensure that restitution is made, but we need to reintegrate people. That's, I think, part of the virtues. We all aspire to these things, but we all fail. So, three questions there, but please feel free to make other comments. Is integrity undermined by some of the puffery which the profession is marketed? You know what I mean by puffery. It's we're so fantastic. I mean, sorry, our best... The best puffs have come today from Annabelle, but she's entitled to be a little over the top. whether all our policy submissions observe justice, ensuring that they serve the public, particularly the most vulnerable, rather than the industry. I think our support for the increase in the super guarantee from 9 to 12 fails on that score. People that suffer are those at the bottom end of the community who already are better off in retirement because they get the age pension. We're taxing them up front because the industry happens to benefit. I think it's a scandal. So, and whether the perpetual search for new fields is wise when the search diverts effort from our major social responsibilities. These are where we can add value: financial risk management and banking and health, perhaps most obviously. But the old our core responsibilities, life insurance, superannuation, and our general insurance. I thought this morning was interesting. We have lost the life industry has lost some of its reputation. We were guardians of the life industry. I don't know where we went. I don't know how we fell short and how we in our guardianship of the industry, but I don't think we've succeeded fully, and I think that we can think a little bit about that. So there's my story. So I'll leave those questions up, but please, I'd be interested in your response.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm very thought-provoking. Actually, I had lots of questions even before you raised your own carefully seeded questions. But I will open to the floor first of all. Hopefully that has piqued some questions in your own minds. If you wouldn't mind, when you do ask a question, if you could give your name and speak into the microphone. As you all know, these sessions are being recorded. Thank you.
Jeff Humphreys. I've got a question, Anthony, that's dogged me a little bit, and that's that the community gives actuaries a monopoly position through legislation. Sorry. Yep. The community gives actuaries a monopoly position through legislation in life insurance, superannuation, etc. And I think that requires an even higher level of integrity from actuaries than you've addressed here, because sometimes that power is used then against the community. I've seen instances of that in both superannuation and the treatment of particularly pension members who are very vulnerable, and I've seen that in the life industry. I just wonder how that sits in your thinking.
So I think some people are given power at various times in communities for structure. So I'm going to stand, if that's all right. Sorry, everyone can see. People are given power, and I think that's why justice is important. because justice, the issue of justice is everyone should be given their due, what they're entitled to. And because it's particularly concerned with power, it's particularly concerned with the powerless. So, I mean, Desmond Tutu, one of my heroes, very few heroes, would say, the preferential option for the poor. The poor need to be considered that's the central thing of justice. So, but justice does cover everything. All the stakeholders, and then it intervenes only where it's necessary to make sure that everyone's needs are covered, that people are treated equally, that people get what they deserve, the sort of just deserts. But it is particularly concerned that for those who can't talk for themselves. So that includes the very elderly, the children, the disabled, and puts us in a very good position on that score, because we are very often in a good position to talk for those three groups of people because of our position in the insurance industries. So that would be my response to if we think in terms of justice, I think we are particularly concerned of them. If we fail to consider the weak, then we failed as people.
Anthony, I'm Brendan Ponya. Can you comment on the application of this regarding our political situation? From South Africa, you can appreciate the massive issues that we're facing there with our president and the issues around his own personal residence. Even our own political situation in Australia, when there's such a... it almost seems that telling fibs is part and parcel of the day-to-day of the profession. Is there some kind of disconnect between how society seems to reward pure dishonesty, and how do we hold ourselves above all of that? And I suppose just some general comment on that.
Thanks, Ben. Read my book. I don't know. Look, I had a section in... Sorry. I had a section in the book on the just war theory, and the just war theory is one of it says basically that only pick the battles that you can win, and then there are other bits about be fair in the way you fight, but that's what I liked, in the sense we can't fight every battle. We're not called to fight every battle. There may be times when, in order to protect our integrity, we want to withdraw from a situation. I confess, I mean, South Africa was a complicated position. The finance world is a complicated position. I've left South Africa, and I've left the business world, and I've stuck in the university where I could now shoot my mouth off without suffering too much penalty. So, I've retreated, and I fully appreciate that people have got to keep their mouths... got to be very careful, I think creativity, there's a call for creativity, and one of the giving voice to values thing is to find creative ways of expressing your needs, and finding, in fact, that people, there are lots of people out there that are on your side, and to encourage people who are really seeking for good things to stand up and be counted, or to work towards change. That the one thing about South Africa, apartheid was never going to go when I was a young man. It'd been gone 20 years. So things can change.
Hi, David Whittle from Zurich Insurance. congratulations on a very interesting and thought-provoking presentation. There's certainly a lot to take away there. I've got a comment and a question. The comment is, it feels to me like we're not the only profession that should be grappling with this. I certainly think the accountants and the lawyers should be grappling with these issues. So that's just a comment. The question, simple question, will your book be on Kindle?
$15. 45 for the paperback, 15 on Kindle.
Is there another question from the floor? Thanks, Brent.
Just the accountants and the legal profession. I think the whole concept of embedding virtue ethics into the actuarial course, it should be in all courses taught at universities. I mean, because at the moment, from my perspective, I'm seeing universities are turning into hotbeds of Marxist ideology that is, you know, antithetical to you know, the long-term prosperity of this country, and we need to do something about that because you know, we're just getting too many examples, like the disgraceful treatment of Sean Lomberg in Western Australia recently, the BDS movement in Sydney is another one. You know, it worries the hell out of me that our universities are turning into something that I don't think is right, but anyway, it's another point.
I don't sit comfortably with the Marxists, but I don't sit comfortably with the positive economists. And my faculty, in our faculty, it's the positive economists that rule. But virtue needs to be taught. But I've given this presentation or something very similar in the faculty of the Australian School of Business 3 or 4 weeks ago, and there were 20 lecturers that were very, very positively inclined to this. We have a community of practices developing it.
Deb Jones, Bretton Watson. Anthony, I'm really worried about usury in our country, and I don't just mean charging interest per se, I mean really unethical practices of charging interest to people who you know are not going to be able to pay. Credit cards, some credit card practices can come into that category, but I'm thinking more of things like payday loans. I'm thinking about things that are advertised on our televisions. Why is it that more people don't recognise, don't see that ad on TV and recognise this is really wrong?
I agree with you fully. My chapter on banking starts with 3 or 4 pages on usury and what's overcharging and the species of overcharging. But I think there are a couple of issues. I mean, I couldn't tell you why the whole politics is such. I mean, it's always possible for the unscrupulous to find a place to practice, and a less than flexible regulator or a less than insightful regulator may miss them. I think the other problem is that usury is actually not seen as a sin, that overcharging is not seen as a sin, that the question of virtue and the justice of monopoly rents, of excess charging, is not taught as a problem. Now, there are a couple of explanations for that. I mean, but one of the things I do is I quote Adam Smith, 4 pages of Adam Smith, with his huge anger at the way in which what he calls monopolists, with their outrageous demands on the public purse. Adam Smith is in favour of free markets, but he recognises that the problem with free markets is not the government, it's monopolists and people that overcharge. And those are the people he is really angry with. And I think the reason why the book has lasted so long is got those wonderful purple passages about his anger. So I think we should feel angry about that. Very difficult to charge. And I've also got a section where, I mean, I work for a non-bank lender that attempted to reduce those payday loan interest rates. And I think I actually made a mistake. We didn't grow the business fast enough because we tried to keep our rates too low. So, you know, we didn't have the resources, we didn't make the profit. So we were charging 25%. Our competitors were charging 60%. The loan sharks, who would kneecap you, were charging 160%. So 60% was better, but if we charged 40%, we would have actually cleaned up. So there are lots of issues to look at.
All right, so thank you so much, Anthony. That was the bell for lunch now. So can you all join me in thanking Anthony for an extremely thought-provoking and stimulating reminder, one of exactly the sorts of reminders you're saying we should, you know, top up on frequently. So thank you.